Well, there are a few, interesting new observation results reported in this Rome meeting on gamma ray bursts. There really wasn't much new on the, there was a SGREXP mini workshop, and I guess it's a good sign that the ITP workshop had lots of all the information, because there was lots of things reported, but there were all things that I'd already seen at the ITP workshop. But in gamma ray bursts, there's a lot of new things. There's a new record holder, high redshift gamma ray burst. This was talked about by Michael Anderson from Finland, and a few other people talked about various aspects of it. It's z equals 4.5, and the previous record holder was z equals 3.4 from Kulkarni et al. That was, the redshift for that was found from a faint Lyman alpha great galaxy. The record holder for absorption lines was z equals 2.0. So this one has actually absorption line evidence for z equals 4.5. It was localized within the name of it is 000131, January 31st. It was localized by the IPN by Batsy, Ulysses, Conus, Wind, and Near. Kevin Hurley got this localization very quickly, within like 10 hours, and they went and looked at it with the ESO Very Large Telescope. And actually, the first observation was 3.5 days later, and they got another observation 5.6 days later. And what they saw was a Lyman alpha break, the onset of the Lyman alpha forest. And of course, at z equals 4.5, the Lyman alpha forest is very, very dense. And so the highest redshift Lyman alpha forest line really gives you a good measurement of the redshift. This was a bright burst. It was peak fluxes in the top 5% of Batsy bursts, fluids in the top 7%. So
not
very far away. Pardon me?
Was this in the afterglow or in the first galaxy? The red Lyman alpha forest.
They didn't say anything about identifying host galaxy
right.
yet.
So it's in the afterglow.
It's just the afterglow, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. And they showed the light curve, and it was a really pretty light curve. I wish I had a transparency of it. It had kind of outline bumps, and then there was a really jiggly place in the middle. And Dan Reichart, who works with Don Lamb in another talk, said that a first analysis of the variability parameter, you know, there's a variability intensity parameter that him and Fenimore and Don Lamb have been working on, and said that it is a very highly variable burst, and so it seems to fit on that line. But he wasn't willing to quote the final analysis of that hadn't been done. They have to do the Poisson smoothing and everything correctly. But if, because it's bright and so far away, it would be 10 to 54 ergs per second if isotropic. So this is close to that record-breaking one, you know, the biggest bang since the big one. if it wasn't beamed, it was isotropic. 99.0123 was like the only factor 3 brighter than this. But it also has a steep slope in the afterglow. Alpha equals 2.2, and that seems to indicate that it is a jet. Since the break had to happen before 3.5 days, Anderson was claiming that the jet angle has to be greater than 7 degrees. So the minimum energy you could have, including that jet, is 5 times 10 to 51 ergs I'm talking about total energy, 5 times 10 to 51 ergs. So, I assume everybody's familiar with this idea. You get a break when you have this relativistically expanding material, and the beaming of the Lorentz factor 1 over gamma, when that approximately equals the intrinsic beam, you get a break, you get a turnover. So they're saying that when they first observed it, it was already a turnover. So and just a few other observational things. I took notes on Piro's, on two other observational. You want to go ahead and talk for this
first? Yeah. Flash of another burst, since that those sorts of breaks to very steep decay have been seen now in maybe a half dozen bursts, or some evidence for breaks, or at least for very steep decay in the initial portions of the afterglow. And this is another example. So it's about a week after the burst that the break occurs, and it's achromatic.
Yeah.
as you expect for.
Yeah, it's very nice that it's achromatic. I think this is what Imperial was talking about, and you have it in, which is what you expect. And he was saying this is a 10-degree period break, isn't it? I think this is. Yeah, there wasn't, I guess another one he was claiming, it isn't that one, there's another one where he was claiming that there was good evidence for achromaticity in the break over optical x-rays. It was 00926, and this was Pirro, it was Veclo-Sachs, and there were Chandra x-ray observations too. Incidentally, the Veclo-Sachs and Chandra position agreed really well, and there was a break in 2 days, 10 degree angle. So I guess, that one is easier to dispute. But the other big thing were iron lines, and there have been some marginal detection of iron lines in the past few years by both Veclo-Sachs and Ascavena, but people are claiming now with higher significance, significance 3 sigma and above, whereas it was a bit below that before. As far as I know, there's a particularly there's one new one was reported that had a really strong looking iron line. This was St. Valentine's Day burst this year, and you have that.
Oh, great!
That's it. Great. Yeah. 3 sigma significance. It looks like 4.7 keV. If interpreted as K alpha emission, then that's Z equals 0.047. So,
that's right.
Yeah, it looks stronger than 3 sigma to me too. I was saying that too, but they say that's what they were claiming. 3 sigma. That's what it says in this abstract here, at least. I think maybe a little bit higher than that. Anyway, there's a lot of talk about where the iron lines come from.
What's the data about 7 kV? They're not going to be there. See that?
Above
7
kV?
Yeah, I mean, I'm showing it's falling off, so it's not really hard to produce. So I can see the 3 sigma falls.
Yeah, it is true. It is true. It's, if it was going to a plateau, then the instrumental sensitivity is dropping off, you might get some sharp line. It certainly tells you that line width is to be suspect, if nothing else. In fact, so they then there were a lot of talk about where these lines come from.
Well, before you just go into that, of course, there's another burst, 9, 9, 12, 16, but claimed evidence in charge respect of both the emission line at about 3.5 angles and then the combination edge at 4.5 angles. That's the termination.
Right.
Combined edge and line features, it's 4.76.
That's right. Veclo-Sachs, they were saying 4.76, and Chandra, they were saying 3.6. So there is one that is claimed.
No. This is a Chandra. That is.
Right, I know. You're talking about 99, 12, 16.
Yes.
I have notes here too that says, and maybe all I wrote was Veclo-Sachs 4.7 sigma, 3.5 keV, broad feature 0.2 keV. And so I've got Chandra, and I wrote Chandra 3 sigma. I can't completely rely on my notes, but if this would be Z equals 1.00, if that's true. So you don't have transparency for that one.
You're really falling on the chart.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of discussion about where you get these lines from, and I don't understand it very well. I mean, I haven't really studied this. It's just trying to absorb some things for the talk. So I'll give you my impressions, and then people that know more about it can. But basically, to explain iron lines, people have invoked something like 1% solar mass and 1 solar mass of iron at distances where light days from the star. And this is usually invoked in a torus, not along the line of sight, so it doesn't interfere with the gamma ray and the afterglow. So you're going to throw off this stuff light days away. And of course, there's a problem on how to get it out there, and there's various suggestions. And because this was in Italy, the thing, the suggestion we heard most about was the supernova, which is caused by Vientre and Stellar. And basically, this idea is that the supernova goes off and produces, throws off some ejecta non-relativistically, and starts moving out. And it also produces a rotationally supported supramassive neutron star. I don't really know. I guess it means overmassive. I guess that's what supra means. Anyway, this thing then spins down. But the usual ways, magnetic dipole radiation, perhaps if you want to, gravitational waves. They don't specify that too much. It's not necessary exactly how it spins down. But it has to then, after days or weeks, once the ejecta moves out non-relativistically to 10 to the 15 centimeters away, which is like order of light day away, then the neutron star collapses, and that's when you get the gamma ray burst. And then when the relativistic shock comes out and hits this material, you make the iron line. So you need this iron up there. And that happens after day. You can also, for a few of these events, apparently there's been rebrightening. There's one 970508, which showed rebrightening after a day or so in the afterglow, and that's when the iron line was observed most strongly. I'm not sure if I got that all right. Oh, you've got transparency on that? Right.
This is a different verse.
Let's see, that's not the one I was hearing about.
And the interpretation in this case, and about a half dozen others, is that you may be seeing a number one supernova.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
On the Redden emission, in weeks later,
that's
as
right.
The power of our shock emission is dropping off sharply, the tenor principle will begin to see an underlying supernova.
So this is optical data here, yeah. I was talking about a rebrightening in X-rays about a day later.
Well, which is in 508, there was about a day after the burst, achromatic brightening in X-rays and optical.
I see, okay.
But
so that's what they're trying to use this.
I don't think that's being viewed too strongly as an underlying supernova.
Yeah.
Interaction with normal ejecta, because there's a visual problem came following that. One day rise.
Fitting onto the 1 day rise.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this kind of model, you'd still want to have the relativistic shock along your line of sight, giving you the basic power law, and then you have this rise happening because of this torus in a different direction, which is what I mean. They're arguing that for 970508. This is what Pirro and Stella were arguing. But anyway, Mazaros gave a talk, and he was arguing something much different for getting these iron lines. And I kind of perked up because he wanted to use magnetars to do it. He was saying, or that was one thing that he was suggesting, one possibility. He was suggesting, though, instead of making it at 10 to 15 centimeters with like 1% solar mass, that you could make it at 10 to 13 centimeters, much closer to the star, like a few light minutes away, with 10 to the minus 8 solar masses of iron, much less iron. And the way he was suggesting this happens is you have some kind of collapsar, and a funnel gets blown open, and this collapsar in the first 1 to 100 seconds, and the gamma ray burst aiming toward us goes out. But the funnel then expands non-relativistically away, out to 10 to the 13 centimeters in a day. So out to a few light minutes in a day. And then there's continuing output from this central engine, which suggests two things from central engine. But that continuing output then illuminates this stuff at much less quantity of iron close by, and gives you the observed iron lines seen in the X-ray afterglow a day later. And what he was suggesting is that this could either be a spinning down magnetar. He also said something about either you're getting rotational energy out of a magnetar, or you're getting magnetic energy over these timescales out of a magnetar. But he needs to, at one day, he was quoting energy is like 247 hertz per second. And then, or you could have, you know, a black hole forming and you have a highly magnetized compact disk of stuff, which is also giving off. That's he was saying that's what you need to I'm not sure, and again, I just took notes from this talk. And actually, Chris Fires, he probably knows a lot about that. I know you've written his paper, but let me just say my impression from the talk is that he was saying that you need something like 10 to 47 ergs per second coming from the central remnant one day afterwards, or hours to days afterwards, in order to then give you the energy seen in these iron line out at 10 to 15 centimeters away. So, yeah, I guess Chris Marcus Botcher, is that right? Your Congress, did I say that right? Yeah, and you've got another way to put the material out from instead of the supernova. You're really kind of more in that camp of the supernova in where the iron comes out from. It's like a light day away. But you get it out there due to the common envelope evolution beforehand or something. Bizarre said something about this.
Yes. So the point is in our case, most of the progenitors things like the collapsar or the moon or the gamma-ray model, you have some common envelope phase where you'll eject material out along the equator during the common envelope phase. And then like
so you get the torus, yeah.
And you have a torus that's not that far out. In our case, in Peter's case, he wants to illuminate the iron with a source, like you just said. In our case, we have the shock from the non-relativistic flow striking that material. And the advantage of doing either of these techniques is if you can get more than one iron emission line, you know, more than one photon from any atom of iron. So you need a lot less iron to make the line. So the original claim to be 0.1 or 1 solar mass of iron out there, you can get they assume that each iron line gets one photon, you know, one iron line. And so both Peter's and our approach, we can get several iron lines, you know, iron photons, decay off of photons with one iron atom.
I guess what you're really ejecting is the hydrogen envelope that has like solar abundance of iron in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you need to. He said something that he was concerned that these kind of things, Mazzaro's, he was concerned that these kind of things didn't make strong enough lines to fit the latest data, but who knows?
Yeah, we gave a prediction, and our prediction was maybe a factor of 5 less than what we observed, or 10 less than what we observed. But there's a lot of, you know, we don't know what the ejected hitting this force is like, so we just picked a value. The velocity and mass of the ejector. And you can change that, and you can change the iron line emission by little order of magnitude. So, I mean, there's a lot of, one of these great theories that there's no, you know, there's many free parameters, so it's hard to kill yet. Hopefully, we'll be able to constrain that.
Yeah. Well, these iron lines are going to be a big guy.
What are the constraints? I mean, obviously, we don't want to have too much iron in the line of sight of the gamma ray in the jet.
So there's obviously a specific strain. And the iron lines are not beamed towards us, so that at least tells you something that you know it hasn't traveled. And the fact that it has, this is totally touchy-feely, but the fact that it looks like it has significant equivalent width seems like that would be unlikely if the continuum is beamed by a factor of, you know, a million lines.
I mean, you have to assume that you only see the gamma ray burst when it's being reported, so there'd be, you know, a lot of these things that
But it's up there. I don't know that there's this thing coming forward,
what gamma was associated with that?
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to see an auto line with, you know, being right at us because the, it's broken and smeared out. The cameras all reacting.
Oh, yeah.
So we can get these instruments that have any sensitive in the iron.
So, there's other stuff about hosts that, I heard Jurgowski host galaxies, and I heard Jurgowski's talk, but I skipped out to see the size of Rome in the main session on this. But Jurgowski just quoted, they've got 20 host galaxies. He quoted work with Bloom and Kulkarni, and I think Bloom gave a more detailed talk to make Chris or you have that. They have 20 host galaxies.
Well, these are HST follow-ups, and this is a slightly degraded picture here, so pull up the web. I think this is the error box, and then there's a fuzz. Here we have some fuzz and maybe a galaxy. It's hard to tell from this particular picture, but there's the error box. Down here, let's see. Down here we have the optical transient, and then we have some galaxy. So here is another set of images. So in a couple of cases, it's just the bang on the center of the background source. This particular case, 990705, is the best case, and it's hard to see here, but this is a spiral galaxy, and the transient is actually localized in the spiral arm. The best case for GRB, which the candidate is actually a massive star. Now what they've done is, and this is all on the web, a recent paper, and Bloom discussed it in a room, is they plotted the position of the transient with respect to the half-light radius. So they rescaled X and Y with respect to the half-light radius. And you can see that some of them lie well within the half-light radius, and then the others cluster fairly closely around. Well, the question is, does this really tell you that you're seeing the explosions of massive stars? Well, not necessarily. There's been a lot of talk about binary, compact binaries having large proper motions and escaping out well beyond the light in the host galaxy, but there are strong selections against large kicks. You want to maintain a binary, and so.
Yeah, so I always think it's a bit confusing. People invoke these large kicks to explain the absence of galaxies.
Of course, but don't you see them?
There are galaxies you're suddenly stuck with these large kicks. That's not necessarily true.
But
some idiots decided that they had.
No one ever bothered to calculate it.
Yeah, exactly.
The kicks have actually been calculated, the distribution of double neutron star binaries. They know what. I mean, we know that Bloom even had used my stuff to visit it, so. You're stuck with some, you know, you should expect some of the double neutron stars to be outside the host galaxy. So far, none of them have, so you can try to give you a couple.
Off light radius?
Well, no, come on, figure out it. Put the whole state of pulsar in a galaxy that has 1/4 the mass of the Milky Way, it would not be in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. So there's even, the examples we have in the Milky Way are only in the Milky Way because the Milky Way.
There's a lot of information.
So the short binaries will have much faster proper motions. And that's,
they merge before they even have the galaxy.
There's now several studies, so everyone who does it in population synthesis, if you understand all their work is crap, or you can say,
well, what's the velocity?
It's like 300 kilometers
per second. For the two solar masses.
For the ones that are like two solar masses.
Yeah, well, the point is, if that makes sense, that means that you're dealing with a kick velocity of 600 photons a second, similar because of the
Well, are you saying that in fact you have done some of this for...
Yeah, remember that you're getting, first of all, you get some motion from the first kid, but you're also getting...
We don't get much motion.
But you're getting a lot of action start. But you get a lot of motion from the ejected materials, and the ejected material plus kid, that's getting more than the others.
Well, why the ejected material, you have that translation of motion?
Because it's going in one direction. Think about it, if you have a, if you have a binary, massive star, and a neutron star spinning around, so you have a massive star around a neutron star, I have an explosion, the massive star is going this way when I have the explosion, its ejecta is going to go this way, but now the binary has to, is going to go the other way. They can go through a common envelope, so then you still have a meaning for it.
Okay, this is a really stupid question. I thought that was the way to make
one.
How else do you get it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, so you eject the hydrogen envelope, but now you have a helium star and a neutron star.
Oh.
And then you have that.
Right.
But there are, I mean, there's probably 10 different problems. So it's pretty well, so there is some uncertainty when you put in kick magnitudes, but to really make the short period binary, you need a big kick. They preferentially go for big kids.
And the uncertainty is in actually how many short binaries you make from those class.
You have some constraints because it's hard to make really close binaries because you can't get the system close enough at the start. You have to have, if you have a helium star, you cannot put its companion neutron star inside the helium will be really slow, so that gives you a nice constraint. And it's hard to make something much closer than 1950 to 60. So it's like 10 to the 9 gear.
You're saying in all the solid cases you have these long graphics related in five times?
Yeah, well you can play around with, the interesting thing is you can play around with the kicks that you bring in, because no one knows that very well. And if you increase the kicks, you get more close binaries, but those tend to be going faster. And so I think it was Portuguese work that had this nice correlation. He said, yes, I can make more short period binaries, but in doing so, I make them go faster, and their net motion is almost the same. So there's almost very, very little how far you go, because when you make them moving faster, to make them shorter periods to merge faster, they tend to be moving faster, and it almost becomes up.
So we could actually have any merge within the time that you have available instead of scrolling off.
Yeah, you can make, it gets harder to make that move. Even the people that are pushing the double the transfer merge don't believe the long duration merge. So that's the way out of it.
Well, yes, and these are all, is that still true? That was this, always this claim that was touched by Excellent, actually only sees the long. We're not talking about the whole population.
The other concern I've heard people say is, would you see an afterglow as something that was not in reasonably close to a host galaxy where it had material hit? Because the afterglow is some from this material hit. You might imagine the afterglow is fainter for ones that don't go in the host galaxy, which would be extremely important by us.
And it's so hard to see that this merge and neutral stars is so natural, right, to give a lot of energy. How else would you see that?
The thing that Gerbowski said when he stopped was that they were claiming on the basis of these associations that it was fully consistent with collapsor models and models where the gamma bursts are in star formation regions. And they were claiming they excluded the binaries at 10 minus 3 or better. That's what he said in his talk. And I think Bloom said that in his talk too.
But of course there's
model assumptions and all the things Chris was talking about going into this. We've got to assume that it's something right.
I'm more worried actually think you're right. Observational selection sounds like a neutral mass of the air.
Yeah, could we do these things, you know, you only see the afterglow. Could we do it in spirals, you only see the afterglows when you're in the spiral?
Galaxy was simply, I mean, against the whole thing, the galaxy is actually a proof of it. Now, galaxy was simply speed 12 of a second. And it's a dark matter potential, which is essentially is logarithmic. And can you really do that much in the galaxy? You've got to take a 300 of a second.
Well, Milky Way is 600. When you put that diagram, I mean, you know, those are lying outside the Milky Way. In fact, what is the relative size of those host galaxies to the size of the relative host galaxies on average that happen inside the Milky Way?
Minkowski put in this number for that. The median offset of the gamma ray burst, when normalized to the host half-life radius, according to him, for their sample of 20, it's 1.2.
Right. But I'm saying divide them up, say, did they do a division where you take those that are inside the half-life radius and say, what does it mean, you know, what they think is the radius? I mean, basically, you say, so the kicks are different in those that are inside the half-life radius, and those that are outside the half-life radius.
And there's a correlation of the
galaxy.
The size of the galaxy.
Right. That's what I'm asking.
So there, is there a correlation of what with position?
Well, you say that the ones which are inside galaxies always, the galaxy is actually massive.
I see. No, he didn't say anything about that.
Did you see Bloom's talk?
No. I see.
I was trapped in Bloom's talk.
This isn't being recorded, is it?
No, it's not.
It wasn't there.
None of this is being recorded today, so you are waiting for you.
So I saw that the laser is actually
moving up and down. I wouldn't be too sure.
Yeah. I told him that I didn't want this recorded.
The most exciting thing was I saw the Pope while I was there. I went to St. Peter's Square, it's full of people, there's a papal audience. So this little tiny white Pope got up with these two big TV screens, and people coming in, and you could see on TV screen people kissing his ring. But the amazing thing about that was the security they had there. There were Vatican cops everywhere, and they put these metal detectors in between the pillars and x-ray machines. And I saw that they were actually x-raying the bags of nuns. Nuns had leather satchels. Now, I guess the assassins could dress as nuns or something.
Well, maybe just a quick couple.
Get the meeting to see that.
A couple other interesting things. Soft x-ray flashes. These are detected with FOSACs. The duration is comparable to that of the large ERBs.
Is this a Don Haxis?
Yes, right. So 10 to 100 seconds. And view review max, very similar to that of the ERBs. And in the terms of the...
This is the things detected with the wide field camera, but not with the gamma ray burst monitors.
Right. And little or no BATC detections.
Are they thermal emission?
No, they're not.
They're non-thermal.
Yep. High energy photon index of about -2 typically. And they tend to sit near the low end of the BATC fluence distribution. Peak flux, 3 × 10⁻⁹ to 6 × 10⁻⁸ ergs per centimeter squared second.
their evaporator sounds consistent with that lowering of the hooks.
I don't know.
I don't know, it's sort of peak, long, I mean, log-in, log-out.
I don't know.
Is he still thinking that there's, is that larger than 10 gamma ray?
Well, but they're
more speculative part of this than I agree.
They have the same duration, so probably not.
No, they would be longer, I mean.
Yeah, they'd have to be the very short bursts that would be stretched up. And then it would be coincidental if they had to. But it's also not at face value consistent with off-axis emission from a jet. You might expect to be softer, both because the material is more slowly moving and because there might be some dilation just due to the geometry. Good question. I think 10 or so.
Off-axis emission from the jet will be on much longer time scale.
That's the problem with that particular model. Yeah. So what this relates to is the question of what is the distribution of spectral break energies in the GRB, because you will recall that in terms of mu f mu, often it looks something like this, the slope of one down here, and this break might typically be around, 300 keV or so. And there's a fairly narrow distribution observed with BATSE, but there's a lot of standing questions as to whether that narrow distribution is a result of instrumental selection or whether it represents some remarkable self-regulation within the bursts. There's some giga data, some giga bursts, which show much softer breaks around 50 keV or so. And I think these events are probably closely related to the Ginga bursts.
How long thermal is the spectrum for these flashes?
High energy index typically minus 2. Both energy index minus 2, so flat and new up new.
But the Ginga bursts are much brighter, of course, right?
I don't remember.
Well, they have to be, right? Because they have that song, many names.
Ginga had a huge collecting area.
Yeah, but Ginga wasn't able to skip break in log n, log s, and gamma ray bursts, right? So it was only collecting that.
These appear to be very closely related to BATSE GRBs.
Say that again.
I mean, these Ginga things are very detected if the Ginga old sky monitor.
Yeah.
So that means it's not a very large collecting area. Yeah. It's just a small.
Oh, that's his question, yeah, right? I see. So there's still rough. Yeah.
Okay.
This microscopic information on the spectral index. I mean.
Well, what I have written down is
not structure or anything. That's just really cool. That's what
I don't think there's much information on the low energy index.
Yeah.
A little bit of discussion of short bursts. You recall that it's very clear now from the final BATSE compilation that there's two distinct clusterings of bursts in the hardness duration. I think this is probably something like channel 3 over channel 1 plane. So these durations might typically be between about, a third of a second, 30 seconds, and these between about, 0.03 and 0.3 seconds, something like that.
I take it that this...
And the short bursts are distinctly harder than the long bursts.
Yeah, and the putative intermediate class, nobody gives that any... Still,
it's at the edge of statistical significance.
Right. Okay. Three cuts in line.
Yeah, it's how you slice and dice it.
Right.
And so, of course, it's the long bursts that have been localized with level sacs and have afterglows. So one question is, how are these short bursts harder? And Bill Jesus has looked at this, and they appear to have systematically higher spectral break energies and systematically harder high and low energy spectral indices.
How confident are they that, given the selection effects?
But the problem is that those are three correlated parameters.
Right.
So if you had the same spectral shape, and you had a limited, because there's some curvature in the spectrum that gives it a limited frequency coverage, then you would By shifting it upward systematically, you expect to see all those three parameters change, and does that matter? But anyway, it doesn't appear to be that there's just one parameter that's changing systematically. And also, in regard to these soft, hard X-ray lags that have been detected from the wrong bursts, soft emission tends to come later after the hard emission typically. It appears that the lags are much, much smaller for the short bursts.
But it's still there?
No. They're consistent with zero.
Okay.
Consistent with a uniform distribution of hard and soft about, you know, mean arrival time. So that's the only fact I've heard significant potential difference between these two classes.
Okay. The fact that afterglows has still not been detected in the short burst, is that, I mean, how bad is that given?
This is such a fact, they can't get the localizations because they're too short.
Well, it's just, okay, so it's not, I mean, I was also just wondering whether it was a problem anyway, because the long bursts are a much larger fraction of the population, right? So. How many, if there were no selection effects, how many would you have expected anyway?
Well, you'd have expected now. Oh, yeah, you'd have expected a number.
So has always been saying that they're just unlucky, that they could do it, and they haven't seen any.
Yeah, every time I tell, you know, give a talk where I say there's, you know, there's a selection effect against Bethlehem-Saxene in the short verse, that some Italian Bethlehem-Saxene comes and yells at me and says, that's not true, we can see the short verse, we're just unlucky. So. I don't know what the truth is.
But when, anyway, the net effect is the same.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, right?
I mean, well, but isn't that disturbing? What you're saying is true. Is it disturbing that you haven't seen?
This is why people are starting to think maybe there's an observational selection effect.
Yeah. Is there any projected reason why there is that illusion? That is, what's the physical phenomenon that caused the illusion?
There are probably two different types of sources.
Well, I understand, but I mean...
Or maybe viewing angles.
We just heard a great idea from Ron Duncan yesterday as to what could be one of the...
Yeah, it's the short ones are contaminated by magnetron flares in nearby galaxies. But that seems to be only a small fraction of them. So what people always talk about is that maybe the short ones are infall of neutron star binaries, and the long ones, there seems to be evidence they're collapse stars. But it's just speculation at this point. But you hear that comment, people get my, and they aren't on the record.
Del Frail gave a review of the status of searches for X-ray optical and radio afterglow. And as has become familiar, there's almost always an X-ray afterglow detected when there's a search for one, but in the optical and radio, the detection rate is much lower, and the question has arisen is, in the case of the optical, that due to reddening, perhaps the GRB source is embedded in a molecular cloud or something like that. Well, that makes it hard to understand why there isn't the radio, and in fact, Fail made a good case that the optical long detections are simply consistent with the upper limits. It's just purely instrumental.
Oh, you mean you in almost all cases,
in almost all cases, if you extrapolated the X-ray spectrum down into the optical, then you would not expect to get a detection.
That's
very
nice.
So, Chris, is there a correlation between the brightness of the afterglow and how far away it is from the center of the host galaxy?
How will I know?
That's not something we just mentioned.
Okay. Isn't that relevant to the point that was being made before regarding the selection effect that you might have, like if it's not near the center?
Well, it depends whether the relative ejector is running into some pre-supernova wind or whether it's running into an interstellar medium. If it were the interstellar medium, I think you're right, you might expect a selection effect. But if it's a wind, then there's no particular reason.
Right.
Typically, I think it's almost always weighted toward lower frequencies, right?
You know, the strip development, that's the...
Typically a power law, but with an index, even a minus two. What else? There's been some continued monitoring of Superintendent 1998 BW, and there's some interesting spectral information regarding the relative velocities of the materials emitting the iron lines versus the optical lines. That's responsible for the optical and iron lines. And the iron lines are significantly broader, so that's perhaps consistent with some jetted emission, like the iron-rich material close to the axis of the jet. The total nickel mass you need, if it's approximately isotropic, which is a significant F, is about half a solar mass, so much, much more than a typical core-collapse supernova. In any case, it's a very peculiar supernova, so it seems, just on that basis, very plausible that it's directly physically associated with that also very peculiar GRB 98045.
But I guess there were some claims that the error boxes moved around or at least last summer. Pira was saying that now they're 7 sigmas apart and...
I don't know.
We've got a few more minutes before we have to give the floor over to our speakers. But
was there anything interesting on AXPs or STRs at this meeting that, besides what was presented by Townsend Duncan or Duncan?
There were interesting things, but we've already heard...
Well, the data, the new data
I see.
That was presented in Rome was largely presented here.
I see, yeah. Okay. There was Ioka, Japanese fellow, he talked about a way to get the spin down shifted on August 27th, and this has been on, he also put this on the web, and his idea is that you have a large-scale change in the magnetic field, so that you have hydromagnetic distortion of this in the context of magnetron model. You have hydromagnetic distortion of this magneton, and then you're going to, in the August 27th event, you're going to change the moment of inertia around the rotation axis suddenly by 1 part 10 to the 4. And to get distortion that high, you need 10 to the 16 Gauss or so, just to change the moment of inertia by that much. So what he really needs to do is flip kind of on the side or change by a large scale change in the field. And he was arguing that this was possible, but I don't think that really makes much sense because if you're going to make a large scale change in the field like that, he did show two states in which the field change, in which the field, the moment inertia around the rotation axis changes, the field changes a lot, but the energies are about the same. But the magnetic energy for that, for 10 to the 16 Gauss, is about 10 to the 49 ergs. And if you're going to make a large scale change in 10 to the 49 ergs, realistically, you have to dissipate a significant fraction of that magnetic energy, and it overproduces energy for the burst. It's a problem. You can imagine making a large-scale change and only dissipating, say, a tenth of the energy. But what he needs to do is dissipate only 1 part 10 to the minus 4. And so I
envisioned my model was that you observe about 10 to the minus 8 of the binding energy of the star coming out of the burst, but you observe a spin down of 10 to the minus 4. The idea is you change the shape of the star in such a way that you change the...
A factor
of 10 to the minus 4, a factor of 10 to the minus 4, but the net change of the gravitational binding energy is 10 to the minus 8.
Right.
Okay. And that's fine, but the problem is that the magnetic energy that you use is of the order of 100,000 times larger than the observed burst energy.
Right. The gravitational energy change is right, but the magnetic energy is too high. So you'd have to get rid of we're only seeing 1 part in 10 to the 4 of the energy that would be released by this. And, you might try to hide it some in neutrinos or something, but to hide, that much, I think it's very, very dubious.
Wouldn't that give it a nice little wobble in the pulsar?
Yeah, well, of course, you always have free precession, and in this case, the free precession is you know, 10 to the 4 times the period. So 8 seconds. So it'd be fast free precession, but it's not clear that you can have that in a neutron star that has superfluid vortices pinned. There's this famous 1977 paper by Shaham who argues that you can't have this kind of precession. So
I guess we'll just see the change in the spin-down rate if the magnetic field was rearranged globally.
Right, that's another concern. That's another concern. The p dot slope would change. Yeah, that's another.
Why does the p dot slope change?
Well, it's just if you're going to make a large scale change in the magnetic field, you might change the dipole moment, right?
Oh,
you're going to
change that.
Yeah.
And well, the inclination.
Right.
Well, even if you don't do that, you get a hardened 10 to the 4. The torque now acts on a moment of inertia that's different by a hardened 10. You get that much jump in the dot.
But that's with both of them and observational error.
Yeah, the 10 to the 4, for these things, that's an observational error. That's a good point. Okay. In principle, you can see that.
Okay, so
I have a question. What did George Ricker say about the status of HETI and the prospects?
Unfortunately, neither of us was there on Friday.
Oh, okay.
All of the new missions were discussed. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Let's take a break.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 minute break.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.